Have you heard the horror story of the really creepy guy who kept a kid locked up in some dungeon?
Ezra Miller?
No, Ethan Hawke and the Black Phone.
Oh. Welcome to Cutthroat Cinema Podcast. I am your host, O.
And I'm your host, L.
And today, in case you couldn't have guessed, we are talking about the Black Phone.
Yeah, and you, like, really dated this podcast. Like,
what? It's all happening around the same time. I fucking care about that creep. But I do care about the creep in this movie, so let's talk about it.
Yeah, the grabber.
Oh, just quickly, if you guys want to follow us, I am O the Horror. That's OOHH the Horror on Instagram.
And Steel Lens Cinema on Instagram. Steel_Lens Cinema.
Steel_Lens_.
Oh, yeah, right.
Fucking stupid.
And yeah. You can follow us on multiple outlets.
Yes.
Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Google Podcasts, Breaker, Radio Public.
Mm-hmm.
Anchor.
Give us a like.
Yes, follow us.
Give us a review, please, if you like our stuff.
Yeah, I think we're a little comedic here.
Yes. And we always post on at Cutthroat Cinema, at Cutthroat_Cinema on Instagram, and Cutthroat Cin Pod on Twitter. We do, you know, interact there quite often, so if you are interested in reaching out, talking to us, maybe even requesting a movie, we absolutely can.
Yes.
Yeah. But like we said, today we're going to be talking about Scott Derrickson's The Black Phone. And just to start, I really enjoyed it. I read the Joe Hill short story a few years ago. I kind of wish I had reread it after we watched the movie the other night, but I'm having trouble finding the book.
Yeah.
In my mess of an apartment.
Yeah, we did a opening night.
Yeah, which we never do. And it was great. I feel like in the past when we go see a movie, we'll either do like super early matinee or we'll do a couple of weeks after it's come out. And the dynamic, I would say, is almost like more hyped on opening night.
Yes, for sure.
Except for the stupid family that brought their 2-year-old.
Oh, stop it. They had nothing better to do.
I'm not exaggerating. Someone brought a 2-year-old to the Black Phone.
They gave him an iPad.
Yes, yeah. All right, whatever.
I really enjoyed this movie.
Yeah, same.
I think I would say more than enjoy, I loved this movie.
I loved it.
I think it still had some flaws, but I'd say 4.5 out of 5. Okay, let's wrap it up. We're done. What else can you say?
No, but if you guys... Do you want to read the premise? Just so
sure.
That's our usual...
I think most people who wanted to see this movie probably know what it's about. But sure, I'll read it. After being abducted by a child killer and locked in a soundproof basement, a 13-year-old boy starts receiving calls on a disconnected phone from the killer's previous victims.
So like I said, it's a short story by Joe Hill with the same title called The Black Phone.
Oh, who is Joe Hill?
Oh, Joe Hill is a writer who is the son of Stephen King.
So he's got some talent?
So he's got some talent. In fact, a lot of his stuff that I've read, I've enjoyed. I actually enjoyed most of the short stories in 20th Century Ghost Stories.
I've never read it.
It's excellent. Yeah. I recommend. I like most of them.
But I probably misplaced it since I'm, you know, locked up all my books after I moved years ago.
I understand.
But I've read some of Joe Hill's work. I've read Horns.
Yeah. I introduced you to Horns, no?
Yes, you did. Yeah. I've read Nosferatu. I
think get through that.
Yeah.
It was very big.
It was a big book. Yeah. I read it.
I just didn't have time.
I read, I can't remember what it was called.
Heart-Shaped Box.
Yes.
I think I've read that. They've been working on a movie for that.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't remember digging Heart-Shaped Box too much.
No.
No. I read like some of his comic series. I think The Cape or something like that.
Was The Cape or The Key and like Lock
no,
and
no.
Key or
Lock
something?
Lock and Key was another one. I haven't read that, though I own the comics. But no, The Cape was another comic book series where I think this guy just gets a hold of a cape that makes him fly and he just becomes like a killer.
Wait. Really?
Yeah.
That's one of the short stories.
Oh, they turned it into a comic book series.
Oh, I shit. Guess? Oh, that's yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. Because that's a really good short story, yeah, yeah. too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's super fucked up.
Yeah, he like goes and kills like his ex-girlfriend. Ex-girlfriend,
yeah. yeah.
And then I think his brother.
And his brother,
him.
Yeah. because
yeah. yeah. Or he murders his brother. I don't oh, okay. remember. Or yeah. his brother murders him or something.
It's pretty it's pretty dark, but yeah, I actually really enjoyed it.
Yeah, Joe Hill's fucked up, too.
Yeah, like, I loved it. But the story... Yeah. But again, I like a lot of his short stories. There was one in particular that I hope they turn into a movie. I want to say it's called like the Happy Face Murders or the Smiley Face Murders. It's the first short story in 20th Century Ghost Stories.
Okay.
And it's about a publisher who reads a super disturbing short story called like the Smiley Face Murders or where people are found once they've been killed with smiley face buttons pinned to their eyes. And it is violently disturbing. And then the guy tries to find the people who wrote it, who submitted it to him.
Okay.
And it's and that itself becomes the short, scary story. Oh, my God. Mm. It's so good.
I know that of the stories that I've read of Joe Hill's, I mean, I haven't read, obviously, The Black Phone. But the ones that have been turned into, like, series or movies, I haven't really dug them too much. I didn't like the Horns movie.
I didn't like the Horns movie as much as the book.
I didn't like the TV series as much as the book of Nosferatu so far. I mean, it's okay. I did not like Lock and Key, the TV series. I thought it was really terrible. But obviously, I haven't read the short story of
The Black Phone.
The Black Phone, but I absolutely love the movie.
Well, as someone who has read it, and again, I really enjoyed the short story. This movie was phenomenal. It doesn't make the mistake that a lot of horror movies do where it's like, oh, we're just gonna briefly talk about these characters and then immediately jump into the action. You have time to learn about these characters, learn about their lives. It's a majority of kids, right? You don't really meet much of the adults, and when they do, they see all the adults kind of seem like scumbags.
Not just kids, like real kids, like kids yeah. who like this. Okay, so this movie, what already I can say about this movie that I loved is one, it brings us back to our childhood,
for
right?
sure.
It is definitely a realistic take on childhood trauma. The realism of like what goes on in your real life childhood, bullying.
Bullying's a big one.
Yeah, how kids really behave, the cursing.
Yeah.
The dynamic, and I have to say, the dynamic between the brother sister in this movie is one, we were both saying to each other, that's us.
Yeah.
And as some of you may know, we're brother and sister, and the dynamic between Mason Thames, I believe is how you say it, and Madeline McGraw is absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, their names in the movie are Finney and Gwen.
Yeah.
And
I think we should just call them Finney and Gwen.
Yeah, it's just easier.
Yeah, yeah.
They are, first of all, you 100% believe that they're brother and sister and that they watch out for each other and then feel bad when they can't help each other. And there's a scene where like Finney is getting his ass kicked, and not because he's not like brave. He doesn't see the need in fighting. Right. But he's such a good kid, and his sister is this foul mouthed little anger, bowl of anger, which, you know, same.
Yeah. Oh, you're trying to say I get beat up?
No, you would throw a punch.
Yes. But before we even get to that, one of the major things I liked about this movie was that, right? Like, I mean, the movie takes place, I think, in 1978 in Denver. I know it was a couple of days ago when we saw it, but I believe even the way the film was shot was meant to look like it was filmed in the era of the 70s.
It was. And 78 is when Halloween came out. Yes. So I think that's supposed to be mm-hmm. like an homage to that,
to
too.
That film. And yeah. there were a lot of homages to the era of horror that the film takes place in. I know Scott Derrickson, the director of the movie, because I think when we were watching it, we were like, oh, look, the daughter has the raincoat. Is this made to look like it? She's bicycling in the rain, you know. Oh, this must be it's like Stephen King's It. But I watched an interview afterwards with him, and he said any coincidences were just that, coincidences.
Who? Scott Derrickson?
Yeah.
Well, you can also kind of see. Because
he's like, that's, he goes, a kid would wear a yellow raincoat in the rain.
Yeah.
It's not meant to mimic it.
There's definite some Stephen King influence in his son's work.
For sure. I mean, that's his son.
Right. So. I mean, and it's not like to shit on Joe Hill or anything like that. The kids in the movie definitely have, like, if you're going based on his dad's work, you could almost call it The Shine, right? The way a lot of these kids in Stephen King's It and in, well, The Shining, right? The way they have this ability to see things that have happened or are going to happen. They have a connection, some sort of like sixth sense where they feel like they could be in the same universe, which I do actually really like, because that'd be an awesome crossover, in my opinion.
No crazy universe crossovers.
No, but I liked
no
it.
No multiverses. No.
The Stephen King Joe Hillverse.
No. What I liked about this movie is that it's contained.
Yes,
and
I
do. Okay, if it's a crazy blockbuster hit, fine. Make your universe.
It might be. I started hearing good things about it when they did the week before, when they did the pre-release for a lot of reviewers.
Mm-hmm. The embargo was lifted?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. And people were just like, holy shit, this is incredible. And again, a lot of YouTubers who I trust, I purposely didn't watch any of their reviews, mm-hmm. either before or after seeing the movie, because, well, you know, like you want to really talk about what you like on your own, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But especially for this movie, you feel for all these characters. You know, the Finney and Gwen come from a bad home life, right? Their mom had killed herself. The dad, to deal with his guilt, had started drinking heavily and, you know, beats the shit out of his kids when he gets mad. And that storyline too, where you're almost tempted to be like, oh, Joe Hill's son is writing about an alcoholic father. Mm-hmm. Who beats their kids. Not saying that he's writing it about Stephen King, but Stephen King himself writes bad parents, mm-hmm. right? Bad parents who abuse their kids and shit like that. So,
well, and you know, like in a way, like King was an alcoholic, I think.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, so who knows? Maybe if, yeah. But he's, mm-hmm. he's, I don't want to say he's somewhat redeemed, mm-hmm. but it's nice to see a dynamic that isn't just, oh, this dad who beats his kids is a piece of shit. He's a piece of shit for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But
there's almost like a reason behind it. In a way, a justified reason. Like there's a reason why he's doing it.
But I wouldn't say justified, but in his mind.
In his mind, yeah. In his point of view.
It's also the 70s when mm-hmm. like beating the shit out of your kids was definitely way more socially acceptable.
Well, not his kind of beating, but...
Yeah, no.
Well, I mean, kids got a belt to the ass, but his was like...
That really, was vicious.
Yeah. But yeah, he's flawed, but he almost has a
turnaround.
Yeah, well, a turnaround. And then he's also got I dislike him, but he's almost got like a redeeming quality to him that doesn't make you absolutely despise him. I mean, you're meant to despise him at first, but then there's like an arc for him.
You soften your views to mm-hmm. him, which again is something nice to see in a departure from the, oh, that parent's a piece of shit because they beat their kid and then that's it.
Well, you look at, you know, to compare again to his father, like Stephen King.
We can't help it. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're going to obviously compare. There's no way around it.
Yeah.
But what's-her-face's dad in It, where he's obviously an abusive molester of his daughter.
Yeah.
Or that's the
sexually
path,
abusive.
Yeah, that's the path it's going on. Or
I think in the novel, it's pretty obvious.
Yes.
And then mm-hmm. in the original... It's not as obvious. He's just like physically abusive to her.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the miniseries, and then in this one, mm-hmm. it's hinted. Meant to be, heavily hinted that.
Yeah, when he's like, you cut your hair, I liked your hair and all that stuff.
Yeah, you're still my little girl.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But so I mean, to get back to just, we're getting off track a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
But I'm going to go back to what, like one of the first things I loved and the feel of the movie, and it brings you back to one, your own childhood, and it gives you that, which is, it's very clever, right? Because And I mean, not to compare it in a way to Stranger Things, right? Because that's like all the rage right now. So is Kate Bush's song "Running Up That Hill," right?
Love that song.
Yes,
I've loved that song for a long time, though.
You don't have to justify it. You don't have to be with people in the YouTube comments going, "Stranger Things didn't bring me here. I was already a fan of this song." Just appreciate that.
I'm glad she's getting the recognition that she deserves after all these years.
She should be paying Stranger Things.
Nah.
I'm joking. But like the kid's journey, right? Like, I love that story. I love the Goonies aspect of it, the Stand By Me, the Monster Squad feel. Like, I just love the idea of, hey, back in the day when we were kids, the neighborhood, the parents who were... Yeah, kids, you can go outside. That freedom of I can leave the house on my bicycle and travel wherever at any time of day from morning till night. And my parents didn't really, not that they didn't care. They were, yeah, don't worry about it, you know? And even though, which was like kind of a flaw of the movie, like how do these parents let their kids go all around and about when there's a grabber picking up kids, which is really the only flaw I had in the movie, but it's understandable. Like, it's not really
what's funny? I gave this movie 5 stars on Letterboxd, mm-hmm. but the more I think about it, there are a couple of issues I had with the movie. It's still completely and utterly realistic to me that families in the 70s would still let their kids go out and about, because unfortunately we're very much, or at least, you know, humans in general, are like, well, it's happening the neighborhood over. What are the chances it's going to happen here? Well, what mm-hmm. are the chances it's going to happen to my kid? Well, what are the chances, right?
Yeah.
But the chances are always high, right? There's always something, you know, in these movies or even in these scenarios, like, why would you risk it? This movie actually kind of reminded me of another movie we really enjoy.
Summer of 84?
Yes.
I knew you. I was,
yes.
It's funny because when I was saying it, I was like, wait, what was the other movie I was going to say? And I forgot for a second. Then I remembered when you started talking.
And
so
both movies kind of have that. No, it's okay. Mm-hmm. Both movies have that kind of nostalgia without being overly nostalgic, right? Yes. Like Stranger mm-hmm. Things, you said,
is nostalgic,
in your face, like, oh, yes. look at this Star Wars poster, yes. look at this Dungeons and Dragons game, oh, mm-hmm. look, Satanic Panic, that was huge in the 80s, and it's like...
Stranger Things, Dungeons and Dragons is like literally what the whole show is based off of.
It is.
It's the driving point.
Yes, but there's, mm-hmm. you know, there's heavy, even like there was a scene last season where Lucas like held up a can of like New Coke and was like, yes. oh, what a better flavor. It's like, what do you do? What's happening yeah. right now? But the reason
they
I think the reason Summer of 84, the only thing I would say is that Summer of 84 is definitely goes there in terms of like fucked up gore, like horrifying situation. Like situations.
That was a really dark.
That was very, very, and not even the ending. Mm-hmm. This is dark too.
This is dark too.
But I feel like it's dark in a different way. Mm-hmm. Maybe focusing more on the family dynamics of being from a broken home, having dealt with abuse. Mm-hmm. Even the killer, even Ethan Hawke's character, you don't learn a lot about him. And this is the reason why I wanted to read the story again before we did this. But like I said, I can't find the thing. I don't remember if in the short story, they mentioned the brother and he's there and he finds stuff out and
mm-hmm. the grabber's brother.
I can't remember the grabber's brother. Mm-hmm. I can't remember if the grabber has more of a backstory, like if he's been abused or if they make point to touch on it. I feel like they did, but I can't be 100% certain.
I like that you don't really know much, but you
you can infer.
Yeah, because you know. The story, the movie reveals stuff about the grabber through the ghosts, right? Because they say the grabber heard the phone ring, he just never picked up.
Yeah.
Implying that he may have been down there as a child or in yeah. the past and he refused to listen. Or you don't necessarily know and he hears the phone ring when he's down there with the children, you know? So there's really no full
You can kind of take it from what you want.
Yeah. Is he hearing the phone ring when he's abusing children? and he doesn't pick up, or was he down there at some point and there's the phone is a gateway to like supernatural entities trying to reach out? So was he abused down there as a child and ghosts were trying to reach out to him to help him? Or when he's down there,
did it only start when he started killing kids?
Yes, right. So, but there's no way to know, so it's left ambiguous.
But yeah,
again, like, to finish what I was saying, like, you get, and I think that's what latched on to me and what made me latch on to this film and enjoy it so much, this memory, this, yes, like, nostalgia for myself, for other movies, this, wow, I remember being able to do all these things. And it's so weird because I don't know if you remember, and I don't know if we mentioned this, there literally was a murder when we were children across the street from our house. You weren't born yet, or you may have been born but just a child, and there were tracks when we were little, and that still never stopped us from going out, and this is how ridiculous our parents were.
This is actually complete news to me. Wow.
So, and but the thing was, the neighborhood was always, you know, people stayed on their stoops, the kids were always out. So I don't know, you know, you're like, and then you, which then you say, you know, and then you're like, oh, how are these kids let out? And now it makes me think, oh, look, there was a body dumped, you know. I don't remember if it was literally across the street, but it was on the tracks that ran through the neighborhood. So, wow. But it was literally like close by, like literally.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm, less than, you know.
But a different time, right? Yes, like, I remember, and this is a time before, you know, obviously cell phones and everything like that. So you don't even have a way to communicate with your kid at that point. Your kid just knew, hey, when the lights on the, like the, on the, when the street lights come up, you better be home.
That doesn't stop Gwen in the movie.
No, it doesn't. She gets up. So the first half of the movie, you kind of just see, you don't see what happens until the main character, Finney, gets kidnapped.
But you get character building.
So you see that he's picked on at school, and he gets his ass saved from being beat by one of his friends, who eventually gets, like, who, the kid is like,
Robin. Yes.
The kid's like a fucking martial artist, right? He beats a kid three times his size with ease.
Who used to pick on Finney,
who, like, broke Finney's nose. That his sister mentions, and she's like, oh, you know, like, why? Like, they walk away because Finney's like, all right, come on, let's walk away from this happening.
We don't need to see the violence.
And she's like, why? That's the same asshole that broke your nose. He's like, I know. She's like, but he deserves it. He goes, dude, like, I get it. Yeah, it's
like,
fine.
Like, it's like Robin overdid it with the beatdown.
With the beatdown, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think the bottom line with Finney is that he's kind but brave, and he'll take a punch if it means, you know.
I don't know if he might be brave, but he won't fight back, and that's his problem. And Rob, it's something Robin says to him
in the bathroom
when three other bullies are going to beat him up, and Robin just happens to walk in and says, leave my boy alone.
Yeah.
And if you saw what happened to, like, whatever the other kid's name was, you know, you mess with Finney, and the same, while he's taping up his fists from the blood and cleaning his hands, he said, there'll come a time in your life where you're going to have to fight back, not just, you know, take the beating and show that you can take a beating.
Yeah.
You know,
a lot of this behavior also probably stems from the fact that his father beats him.
Yeah.
And it's pretty clear because the sister, like we said, has this like psychic ability, and when
she has the sixth sense, maybe, or
when the first kid goes missing, or one of the first kids, because it's already like started happening, but one of the first kids who goes missing is a boy that was on the opposing baseball team from Finney, and Finney has like a hell of a pitch, and they talk a little bit after the game about it, and then he goes missing a couple of days later. She tells his sister, I had a dream about your brother, and there were black balloons, which brings the cops to the school to talk to her, which is a phenomenal scene because she curses them out, and it's fantastic because it's like, she's like, yeah, assholes, I fucking took him, right? Yeah. Like,
she's very defensive.
She's very defensive.
Very antagonistic, too.
Yeah, which is great. But she also gets the shit beat out of her by her father because she mentioned the dream, and then they came to his work
to question him.
So you see that obviously this is a pattern for him. He drinks, he gets upset, he beats his kids until they listen. So he's probably used to, and you also see the dynamic in the morning when, you know, he's hungover and they're getting ready for school. You're chewing too loudly. Mm-hmm. You're making your toast too loudly, right? And they have to apologize and they have to be quiet. And they, so he kind of learns that behavior at home, but it doesn't mean that he doesn't know how to stand up for himself when it's necessary. And in this movie, it becomes necessary. Once he's captured by Ethan Hawke, which, by the way, you don't really get an introduction to Ethan Hawke until about halfway through the fucking movie, mm-hmm. which I think is also great. It's very much like Jaws. You know, you don't see the monster until almost the very end of the movie. And it felt the same way in this.
You know, he's lurking out
there. He's lurking. Mm-hmm. You'll see his van. You'll maybe see him in like a blurred shot from far away. But you never meet him until he's, you know, trying to get Finney into the van. And then when he comes down with that fucking creepy, like, mask, removable mask parts.
Yeah, and two-piece mask.
It's a, yeah, well, technically it's a three-piece mask. He has the eyes, and then it has three different bottom masks. The one with no mouth, which is creepier than the other two, but one with the manic, smiley, Joker-like face, and then with the frown. And he wears them for different reasons. And I want to watch the movie a few more times to kind of like gauge what maybe their uses are for. Like, I think when he's upset, he uses the sad. And when, and like, I guess the reason he's blank the first time is because Finney doesn't know him yet.
When he abducts him?
Yeah. So the entire time Finney's there, he starts hearing the phone ringing. And he is, at first, like, he goes to answer and, Ethan Hawke, the grabber, is there. Because I don't think he even has a name in the movie. I think he just goes the grabber.
Well, yeah, the media and the police have, like, dubbed him the grabber. So that's his, you know, that's his...
That's his name.
Yeah.
He sees him, he sees Finney on the phone, and he's like, it's not connected. He's like, I used to pick up that phone, too. Which, again, gives you a little mm-hmm. insight that he used to be locked down there. He gets a little freaked out the first time he hears someone calling his name on the other side when he knows it's disconnected. And eventually he starts listening, and it's the ghosts of the other kids. Super creepy, like, just camera work where he's not seeing the ghosts, but the ghosts are in the room talking to him. In fact, the first time they show a ghost, I screamed like a little bitch.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing that the director and does to the audience, that the audience are seeing the ghost, but Finney is not.
Right. He's just hearing them.
Yeah, he's just hearing them.
I would say as far as jump scares are concerned, there's maybe two or three in the movie. One I was like prepared for because of how they set it up, but the other two come out of like the nowhere. Fucking blue.
Yeah, which you, is you really?
Yeah, no, I did. Yeah,
you jumped to the point that you made me jump.
Yeah.
So I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
And you screamed.
The first one, I sure did. Not the second one, but I definitely screamed at first one.
And another thing with the ghost, and that I enjoy, that both brother and sister in this movie are well aware of the missing children. The Scott Derrickson makes it a point, as well as the writer, like, to make sure you, the audience, know that the kids know about all the children missing. They're aware of the posters that are going up, missing children. They know the names of the kids, whether they're not necessarily friends with them or just that they're well aware of who they are and that they have taken an interest in the case. Either that Finney is just, because he's obviously a smart kid. In fact, he was tutoring Robin, and that's why he had protection from Robin, because Finney is just a good kid.
Yeah.
So he didn't befriend Robin for bully protection. He just,
because they were friends.
They were friends.
And he needed help with his math, and he was happy to help him.
Yes. So, and there's obviously concern for what's going on, and you have two good kids who are just like, hey, like, something terrible is going on, and they just took an interest in, like these kids are missing. They learned their names. They know everything about it. So when the calls start coming in, Finney is able to determine who the other person is on the phone.
Yeah.
Which the ones who have been missing for too long can't even remember their own names. So I really enjoyed that aspect of the movie as well, that they're lost to, let's say, like the afterlife or the void for so long, they start forgetting who they are, but they know what the killer has done. And this is where the movie starts laying out the plot for the escape, the eventual escape and climax of the movie, which is still, like we said, like halfway through.
Right. Like this movie isn't afraid to take its time, which I so fucking appreciate. And I wouldn't even go as far to say that it's a slow burn, because it's not. No. Things are happening in the background and you see them in a lot of the scenes. You see the black van, you see the characters, the kids getting, some of the kids getting taken. You see the interactions between the police and the kids and the parents and the kids. And the love and concern that the brother and sister have for each other. And, oh, it's Friday night, I'm going to my friend's house. Gwen always goes to her friend's house on Friday night.
Friday night, yes.
Yeah,
and then they make sure to show that to you like two or three times.
They do. Mm-hmm. So it's not a one-off thing when he goes missing, because on the walk home.
Oh, like how convenient it's Friday. It's Friday.
Right. No, they do it every Friday. Times, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which, again, the movie has the time to build it up. And I'll give credit to Scott Derrickson and C. Robert Cargill, the writer, because I think Scott Derrickson wrote the screenplay for the Joe Hill story along with C. Robert Cargill.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they did.
And they're just...
And they both did Sinister,
too. They both did Sinister. With Ethan Hawke. And Max, the brother.
The brother.
Mm-hmm. Right. Who was in Stephen King's It as the older Eddie.
Yeah, and he was the cop in... Sinister, right? Yeah.
The universe
was in Sinister 2.
Yeah.
Which is actually a little underrated. I don't know why people crap on them.
The universes are connected already.
No, they're not.
Yay.
No, they were completely different characters.
Anyway, the interesting thing about... Let it go. Let it go.
Joe Hill universe.
So as the investigation is going on outside, they actually... The cops kind of start believing the sister in regards to her abilities.
Which I admired,
right? Because she's like, what reason do I have to lie, right?
Yeah. How would I have this information?
How would I have this information?
Mm-hmm. I loved her little Jesus prayers and then like cursing about it. Yeah. And like
when she can't get a fucking vision, she goes, Jesus, what the fuck?
Yes. it was so cute. Good. It was funny.
She was great.
That you're laughing and then you're worried.
Horrified.
And then, like, yes, this movie was a cluster of emotions for me. And Gwen is fantastic in it. And I love her little dollhouse praying to Jesus when, in fact, it's, you know, she thinks it's God sending her the message. And
But it might just be her own abilities.
Her psychic
and you abilities. Find out that, like, the mom had the similar thing.
Which drove her crazy
and then drove her to kill herself, which is why the father is also so upset that the daughter keeps talking about the dreams.
But this is where the, like, you know, redemption arc, where the daughter tells him, you know, like, these, you know, I'm not crazy. I loved mommy and I'm having these dreams and I may be able to find Finny, you know. And the father takes her out.
Yeah, he takes her driving around
for the house. Yeah. That he could be...
They tell the cops, because then they go house to house in areas that are, you know, like familiar and like so where the kids are going missing.
This is where you realize the dad what was his name? But he's mostly known for Lost.
Jeremy Davies.
Jeremy Davies. And he was on Constantine too.
Was he?
Yeah, he was.
I'm familiar with that actor.
The TV series Constantine.
From Lost.
From Lost, yeah. He's been in a couple of things though. He was actually very good in this. And this is where you realize that his abuse and toxicity may have been from extreme depression after the loss of his wife. And that his abuse of his children are, I don't want you to end up like her.
Yeah.
Like, you need to suppress whatever it is that's happening to you. Because, I mean, out of love, I can't lose you. But look what it was doing to him.
Yeah, it was turning him into a monster.
A monster, yes. So he takes his daughter out to look for his son, which, you know... You're like, oh, okay, he's not necessarily the piece of shit youth. That he's not just the abusive father. Yeah.
Well, now that his son is missing, he has to worry about, like, can we find him? Mm-hmm. Now I only have this one kid left, and if this guy kills my son, like, what's going to happen?
And so let's be honest, everybody knows that he's... I mean, there's no bodies turning up, but these kids have been missing for years. So
Months. Yeah, months. Something else interesting that I only really noticed afterwards, the kids who went missing prior were all pretty athletic. So, you know, there's five boys who went missing prior to Finney getting kidnapped. And all of them were either like, I work on the paper route. So I'm like, you know, I have, he's strong from being able to ride a bike literally all around the neighborhood. Baseball player, some tough delinquent. And then the kid who does karate, right? Mm-hmm. Which just goes to show you, even if you're like the biggest, baddest kid in town, an adult attacking you and surprising you, like, it doesn't mean that you'll get away. It mean, mm-hmm. like, it doesn't mean anything, right? So I like that Finney, who isn't the most, like, he's on a baseball team, but he's the pitcher, right? So he's maybe not the, like super-duper athletic. He's not the strongest, but he's got a super strong arm.
Well, he's got a strong arm.
He's got a strong arm, and he's really smart, and he's willing to listen. And I think all those characteristics help him in the end. Something that they play at in the movie is when he's talking to the ghosts, they kind of repeat themselves. It's pretty much the same, like, three or four lines from the ghost, and they can't help but repeat themselves, which reminded me of a Doctor Who episode. But
well, it seems like the longer they've been dead, the further they are from being able to have a legit conversation with him.
But there's a reason. And as the movie goes on, he tries each kid's escape plan. Mm-hmm. So the first kid tried digging up the floor, right? Mm-hmm. So then he tries digging up the floor and then just keeps covering it.
There's nothing there,
but he just keeps digging and keeps digging. Then the second kid tried escaping through the window. Mm-hmm. And then another kid hit
the window, had the metal bars
on mm-hmm. it. And the other kid had a rope that he mm-hmm. was trying to use. So he uses the rope to try to open the window, but it doesn't work.
But it pulls the rack off
mm-hmm. the window. Then another kid uses the toilet seat cover to bash through a wall where the freezer is, and he tries to take like the meat out and then break through, but it doesn't work
because the freezer's locked on the other side,
right? Mm-hmm. And then another kid knows that the grabber is using his bike lock with his combination on the door to the outside. So even though he falls asleep sitting on the chair and he actually manages to escape for a few minutes, the grabber gets him again and threatens to kill him on the spot.
And one of the ghosts warns him not to go up the steps when he leaves the door unlocked because he beats them every time. It's a game he's playing.
Yeah. And he's not playing it.
Yeah. And he keeps passing out, waiting for Finney to come up because his game is to beat them when they come up the steps.
Right. And he doesn't sleep when the kids don't play. So then he gets tired and then falls asleep. And that's how mm-hmm. Finney's able to escape the first time. So while all this is going on here, Gwen is getting more and more like visions and dreams and little pieces and clues, but nothing substantial, which I like, right? It's not, oh, look, it's in your face. She's getting the one dream all of the time. It's a little bit at a time. It's broken up. So you believe that she's looking around the neighborhood. You see her leaving her house at like 4 a.m. mm-hmm. to drive around with her bike by herself, trying to see like what can I find? And it's just, again, you believe these characters. And then when the cops go to a house in the neighborhood that's kind of like in the middle of all the abductions, Max answers. The character from
Sinister?
From Sinister, the cop from Sinister.
He doesn't look anything like himself in this.
He doesn't. Well, it's 70s, right? Mm-hmm. He's like bigger hair, sideburns. Jumpsuit. He's doing coke on the table, right?
Yeah, he's in a jumpsuit, right?
He's in a one of those like jumpsuit looking outfits. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, oh, I'm staying with my brother and, you know, I don't have a job right now.
He's actually trying to help with the investigation.
He's trying to help with the investigation because he's so like, he feels so bad for these kids that are going missing. And the cops are just like, all right, yeah, like we know that's why we're here mm-hmm. looking. So they're like, maybe clean up before your brother gets home. He's got like coke on the table, right? Yeah.
They're so focused on the investigation, they don't even arrest him.
They don't even arrest him for the coke. Mm-hmm. They're like, whatever. So they leave, and then he goes to do more coke, and it pans down, and you find out that it's the brother's house where Finney is being kept. So he doesn't even know that he has a kid in the basement.
Which is the reason why technically Finney's still alive, because
his brother just showed up.
Yeah, he showed up out of nowhere. The grabber can't enact his full plan of killing him.
Well, don't forget, Finney, because he's so smart, when the grabber goes down there and says, well, we can't do anything right now. You know, something came up. And he's like, is someone else upstairs? Is
someone else upstairs, yeah.
And it's like, oh, you don't have to worry about him. We're going to work. And he goes, mm-hmm. him. And then he gets mad.
Yeah.
And then mm-hmm. leaves and locks the door. So he Finney was able to get information out of him without even trying, yeah. really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he gives away the info, willingly, but not realizing how smart
Finney yeah. is, mm-hmm. right? Because whereas the other kids were probably just, all brute force and trying to, kick this guy's ass, he was able to, outsmart him. The best part of this movie is, obviously the climax. The last person, the last ghost that talks to him is Robin, his friend, the one that was taken.
Who told him at the start of the movie, there'll come a time where you have to fight back. You have to stand up for yourself.
And he, he obviously doubts himself and he's like, I can't do this. You were so tough and you couldn't even take him.
Yeah. And it's, and when we say climax, because literally Gwen's dream tells her, in the dream today, this is it. This is the day, right? I mean, I can't fully remember.
She sees the grabber outside with the black balloons clearly. And then she sees the house and the house number clearly.
But I could have sworn something in her dream says this is, I think either the grabber says it or that this is the day.
Or she sees the brother banging on the window or something.
That happened earlier.
Oh, right, right,
something
right.
Happens so she, in the dream that says, sets her off saying, today is the day.
It's when the brother is talking to the ghost of the tough, delinquent kid
mm-hmm.
who carved a number into another kid's arm.
Mm-hmm.
But she's seeing it as the way this it's done is beautiful, right? Because mm-hmm. you're seeing it as if it's a flashback, but it's actually a dream mm-hmm. That she's in. So we've seen flashbacks throughout the movie of these kids growing up, getting taken. But for this instance, you see, I can't remember the kid's name, but he's clearly a delinquent.
He's the town delinquent.
He's, mm-hmm. he kind of looks like Eddie Munson from Stranger Things.
Yeah, he
with blonde
does.
Hair.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets into fights and he stabs other kids and he's maybe slightly older than the other boys.
Vance. I think his name is Vance.
Vance. Yeah. Yeah, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets taken by the police and put in a cop car. But then you see the sister and you see her walking and then you see her getting into the cop car and you're like, holy shit, this is a great little scene of.
And that tree. There's always a tree.
Then there's they drive by. And as he's talking to Finney, she's hearing what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
So he's saying stuff like, today's the day. Like you're going to die today.
Yeah,
everything goes down today.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you think it's because he's talking to Finney and you're seeing the flashback, but it's literally because it's her dream too.
Yeah,
again,
it's like a flashback, flash forward.
It's a flashback in a dream sequence. It's fantastic.
It's the culmination of everything that's going to happen.
It's great.
Yeah.
So
and she literally calls the police and pressures them, you have to go to this address. Everything is going down
right now. Because she's riding her bike and she gets scared and because five ghosts fucking just pop up in front of her, which was the other,
Jump scare. And that was the night before, right?
No, that was the day of. She figures it out. Then she goes and she calls the police.
Oh, she sees the address for real.
She sees the address mm-hmm. for real. And you assume the address that she's sending them to is the address of where Finney is being kept. But we'll get back to that.
Mm-hmm.
So Robin is kind of advising Finney on the phone on how to hit, how to pull your arm back do the hit.
He trains him. He tells him to stuff the phone with dirt to make it a heavier object.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really all he tells him.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the culmination of everything else that Finney has learned from the other ghosts.
Yeah, he that prepares a whole trap.
Essentially puts a trap in mm-hmm. place for the grabber. But what you think is about to happen is that the grabber is coming down. Well, it's supposed to make you think, but you end up seeing Max, the brother.
Yeah, who comes out of his little coke haze. Yeah, and looks at the map that he created and realizes
he's in the center.
He's the center and goes into the basement. And when you think Finney's about to lay out his plan, his trap, the brother shows up and obviously Finney realizes it's not Ethan Hawke,
yeah,
and it's the other, like his brother.
There. Yeah, or like someone, the he's other, like, holy shit, I knew it was, you know, mm-hmm. I knew he was keeping someone down here. This is so fucked. And he's like, please.
Get you out of here.
He's like, he I'm going to get you out of
here. He goes, you want to know how I figured out you were here?
Yeah, and then he goes, oh no, because he hears the grabber, and then you see a fucking axe go through the brother's head.
Like a hatchet goes right through his head or something.
And he kills his brother. And
then he blames Finney for it.
Yeah. And then he's like, I'm going to take my time with you. And it's just so fucking creepy. It's like next level creepy because you already know he's, God knows, like they don't really ever say what he does to these kids before killing them.
You know he over-tortured the delinquent.
Yeah.
Because the delinquent sabotaged the whole basement.
Yeah.
He did like the most damage and everything. So
he,
the ghost shows like his eyes are missing and everything.
You know, it's, They never explicitly tell you what happens to the kid. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's like sexual abuse included too, but like or if it's just straight torture and then murder. Mm-hmm. But it's, I don't even want to say it's implied, like, because you don't know, you have no idea. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty fucked up, no matter what. And again, very much kind of like Summer of '84 vibes, right? Multiple kids are missing at once. They're being like buried in places, and you're like, it's just, I keep recalling scenes from that movie that seem very familiar, right? Mm-hmm. I think if you like The Black Phone, or if you like Summer of '84, watch the other and see how you feel.
Mm-hmm. Summer of '84 didn't get a movie theater release though, did it? And if it did, it must have been like,
I don't think it did.
If it did, it probably got like film festival stuff.
And that's a shame, because that movie is so, it, I mean, this movie essentially has a happy ending. That movie's a fucking downer of an ending.
Yeah, that was a downer for real.
That's really the only difference. Not only difference, but there's
there's no supernatural aspect.
There's no supernatural aspect. Yeah. It's just a downer of an ending.
But yeah, so the plan is laid out. The steps are in effect. And Ethan Hawke goes after Finney. Well, the grabber. And we're calling Ethan Hawke. And he falls right into his trap.
He does.
He chases him. The hole that he dug up from the first ghost giving him the what to do, he falls into the hole. The metal rack that was in the window.
From the second ghost, he breaks his ankle and gets stuck in it.
The cord.
He trips on the cord.
Yeah. The cord is what tripped him to fall into it.
Into the hole, yeah.
The phone that was stuffed with dirt that Robin told him to stuff.
He starts using it and beating him in the face.
Right. And then, because he grabs him, so he uses the phone to crack him over the head multiple times.
Yep.
And then that rope that he tripped over, he uses to choke him out with.
Yeah.
And then what I thought was excellent.
Yeah.
He uses the ravishing Rick Rude neck breaker that...
Because these kids in the 70s are watching wrestling.
Watching wrestling. And he watched Robin use it on the bully. In the beginning of the movie.
Very true.
He used a neck breaker wrestling hold to take down Robin and to take down the bully and essentially choke him out and get him down to the ground.
Yeah. And before he breaks his neck, though, like he gets him down to the ground. He still has the phone and the phone starts ringing. And the grabber looks back at the phone.
He hears it
because
ringing.
He hears it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes. So Finney takes the phone and he goes, this is for you.
Yeah.
And he puts it up to his ear, and all the lines that kind of kept getting repeated from each previous kid could be used to talk to either Finney or to the grabber. And the grabber is essentially getting an earful from the kids he murdered, saying, like, fuck you. This is your day. You deserve this, you piece of shit. You know, like, and it's just like a perfect little culmination of karma, and then he fucking snaps his neck.
But
right
now, while this was happening, or like right before this was happening, in the other, while the cops, you think we're going to go into this house, we have a kind of Silence of the Lambs
situation. Yeah, absolutely.
Where they're in, where you think they're going into this house, they were going into another house, and it was the house where the bodies were buried.
So there's, right, so the cops go through it and they're like, oh, there's no one here. Yeah. And they're about to leave. And one of the cops who's doing like a final sweep says, wait, I have a cellar door.
Yeah, how'd they miss that on their first sweep? Come
right. But then they move the fridge, they open the cellar door. And what you're thinking is going to happen is they're going to see Finney there. They don't.
Mm-hmm.
it's
the buried bodies.
It's the buried bodies. And then literally as everyone is waiting across the street and they're looking at the bodies, Finney emerges from the house across the street, unlocks the door because now he knows the combination, walks out, and his sister sees him, and they you know, embrace, and it's sad and beautiful, and you're so happy he's alive, and you're so happy the sister helped, and you're so happy the cops listen to her, and then everybody comes running out. Even the father has a final moment with the kids where he's like, he goes, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Like, I'm so sorry what I did to you. And
yeah, and what I liked is that they didn't really embrace him.
They didn't. They embraced each other.
Each other, yeah.
Well, earlier in the movie when she had gotten, like, her ass beat, he was sitting in front of the TV. And then she sat next to him and just put her head on his shoulder. Fucking words.
Now he has his head on her shoulder.
Yeah, it was just like this beautiful little like 180 moment. It's just
like, I like you had the juxtaposition from the houses, and then now you had this scene from earlier. Like, it was just
a very well done.
It was a molto bene. It's a very nice, you know.
Yeah, so, there's a lot of really good like setup and payoff in this movie, and I really loved it.
I really hope it does well. I have no idea how it's
doing right
now. Yeah, why don't you look it up, sis?
The fuck?
Tell me, oh, the horror, how it's doing. Tell me it's making multiple money.
Hold on, let me try to find box office on this shit.
I want to say as of like yesterday it was at 10 million, which I'm not too crazy about. I wish it was doing much better. But you got summer blockbusters, and this coming out in the summer, I don't think was too smart.
Right now, the gross US and Canada is 10.2. Gross worldwide is 10.251.
So it's not released worldwide yet? That's not good.
Or it is. It's just 10.251. It's slightly more. What was the thing?
That's not good. The budget?
Yeah.
Probably around the same thing.
What, 10 million?
Yeah. I mean, that's good in the sense that it'll make money. Why this release a summer blockbuster?
Well, I think it was supposed to come out last year, but it was the... Oh, man, that sucks. Well, the budget is 16 million.
Yeah, it'll do okay.
I hope so. I mean, it's right now. It's Sunday.
They're still gonna see Downtown Abbey. Go see the scary movie.
It came out Thursday,
yeah,
like officially, and then Sunday. I'm hoping like maybe by Monday, Tuesday we'll have like updated and it'll.
Yeah, IMDb is not even updated yet because it's not even in top 10. It's definitely making more than
for sure.
Yeah, Weekend Gross. Yeah, this movie, Weekend Gross, 216,000. Yeah, the IMDb's not updated yet. You got to go to...
But the thing about the movie is that it feels right for the time it came out. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it feels like a summer movie. The events in the movie take place close to summer, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, the kids are still in school, it's like, it's hot out, you know? You can see it happening around that time.
Sure. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Elvis, 12 million. Oh, Elvis is not even doing that great. Black Phone, 10 million. Well, this is Friday, June 24th, latest dailies. So if Friday made 10.2 million, we're on Sunday. I think it's going to do
I think
okay.
It'll be all right.
I think it was safe.
Well, yeah. But that's the thing. I think that it's getting huge word of mouth. Everyone on Twitter is talking about it.
Well, Twitter's not real.
I know, but I think the fact that there are so many people like raving about it in horror networks.
I think Elvis will probably be number one because of like, you know, these musical stuff tend to do pretty well.
Yeah, and it's like one of those like crazy biopics.
Yeah, yeah. So. And it's got Tom Hanks in it. Though is Tom Hanks, does he got that pull anymore? I don't think so. No, I don't think he's got that kind of pull anymore.
I wouldn't even say people would go to see this for Ethan Hawke. They would go see it because it looks like a good movie.
Though, can I say, like, Ethan Hawke is one of the most underrated actors of our generation?
Yeah. You know what? Not to sound weird, but I kind of wish he was in more of this movie. I know we're like, oh, it's great because you don't see him for like half of it, but he's also not in much of the second half either.
No, but I think that gives him more of like a terrified, like, you don't see too much of him. It makes him scarier.
You know what I appreciate?
What?
That he's not one of these actors that need to show his face every 5 minutes.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, well, why am I wearing a mask? I'm Ethan Hawke. People got to see my face. Pedro. Anyway.
Yeah. Pedro.
Not to be an asshole, but like, if your character If your character...
Yes, Sylvester Stallone.
Yes, Stallone. Yeah. You stupid prick.
Yeah, Judge Dredd. Not like my boy, Carl Urban.
Who yeah, was Carl
like,
Urban.
I don't need to take off my
shout
mask.
Shout out to Carl Urban, who's like, what? Yeah, no, this character wears the mask.
Who
I get
everybody,
it.
Who calls everybody a cunt.
Yeah. But no, like, it's true. Like, you have people like Pedro Pascal and Sylvester Stallone who are like, well, why, you know, why can't I show my face more? Like,
your character
it doesn't remove their helmet.
And I mean, not that I saw it, but that stupid show with the Xbox game. What's that called? Oh, Halo.
Halo. Yeah. Oh, right. And Master Chief never takes off his thing, but they keep finding reasons. That's Pablo Schreiber. Liev Schreiber's brother.
Oh, really?
Brother or like half brother. They kind of look alike.
I don't know. I don't care.
But yeah, there's a ton of actors who are just like, well, why am I doing this if I can't show my face? But it's like, you have an actor like Ethan Hawke and Carl Urban who are like,
take your mask this off is on the role. Cover of Esquire or something.
Right. This is the requirement for the role.
Yeah.
And you know, it's necessary and it's good for the film and it's good for the ambiance and it's good for all this stuff. The only thing I can maybe see there, you know, with Pedro Pascal and Pablo Schreiber is it's TV shows, so it's much longer shooting schedules. So maybe that's the frustration a little bit.
Well, you take your mask off on the cut.
Fair.
Look, I just know I appreciated Ethan Hawke in this, and I enjoyed everyone in this movie. Everyone.
These kids were fucking fantastic.
Yeah. I mean,
amazing.
Like not to bring up Star Wars, right? But I look at and I know and I'm not.
It's my
not,
fault because I mentioned The Mandalorian.
You brought up Star Wars, not me. Okay. Technically, you started this. You brought down the thunder. Well, now you got it. And not to shit on like kid actors, right? But like the kid who did Leia, right? I know I think she's like 10 years old. But like she should have been in like one episode because she really couldn't carry a series, you know? Like she should have had limited parts, right? Because she wasn't that great.
I don't watch it, so.
Yeah, well, I gave up on it because it was terrible. But and I just don't blame her. I thought everybody was terrible. Like everyone. Even like Anakin and Hayden Christensen and
Ewan McGregor.
Oh my God, Ewan McGregor, the third sister. Everybody.
Some bad. Goes to show you the strength of Scott Derrickson and C. Robert Cargill, right? That they know how to write a script. That they know how to make it so that the characters are either super likable or super unlikable.
Yeah. Well, like Deborah Chow didn't direct the show well, and the writers didn't even know like their Star Wars history, you know, like, and that's where you have the problem. Like good directors, good writers make good shows or good movies.
Right.
If you don't have those, like, can you really even blame, like, yes, I guess you can blame actors, right? You have Ewan fucking McGregor, right? How does Ewan McGregor suck, you know?
Yeah, right. Like, Ewan McGregor is one of the more talented actors out there.
Absolutely. And I mean, yes, was he the best part of the show? For sure. But when I'm saying like, bro, like you're sucking right now, something is wrong, okay? So, and this is like, okay, maybe Deborah Chow wasn't the best director for the show. Clearly the writer who I could give two shits what his name is because, and I think there were multiple writers.
There are multiple writers.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and that's like another problem. Like, why do you have so many fucking writers?
So
why
that's
do you have
the so thing. Many producers? A movie like this where you can very easily get bogged down in like, oh, this is the history of the grabber and this is what he had to go through. And I don't know why we're trying to make this piece of shit sympathetic. But that's the thing. They don't focus on any of that, right?
Can I say Scott Derrickson dodged the bullet with Doctor Strange too?
Yeah, I think he got out of that.
Yeah. Because
I wonder, now having seen Doctor Strange 2 and knowing Scott Derrickson's affinity for like horror, I'm wondering if he wanted to make it much, much darker and they were just like, no, because it's Disney now.
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I've heard rumors that like Sam Raimi was like technically like practically fired and just told to sit on set, you know?
Yeah. No, that's not true. There's no way.
I heard Chris Gore, who's like a huge Hollywood person.
Oh yeah. I follow Chris Gore.
Yeah. I follow him too. Said that, you know, I mean, I don't know how true it is and I wish, like, I don't want to like say things that aren't true, but I can believe that because most of the directors for Disney Marvel movies basically do that. They film just little things and then it's the freaking CGI people that handle everything else. So you're practically already not directing. And like, let's be honest, I mean, I finally saw Doctor Strange and
Part 2.
Did not like it. Like
it wasn't good.
It had like some moments, but I love Sam Raimi, you know, from like, but I love him from like the Evil Dead days.
Well, the same
and,
thing
and
with
like and this and you know what, and honestly going back to the Spider-Man movies, like they were just like okay now when I look back at them. Like in the
I disagree. I like the Spider-Man movies.
When was the last time you saw the Spider-Man movies? Can I ask you?
About a month ago, because we had the girls rewatch all.
Oh, okay, all right. No, I don't.
I actually don't think three is as bad as people make it out to be. That's terrible. Literally, no. Rewatch all three movies.
I still like Spider-Man 1 more than Spider-Man 2.
Okay, we should probably not go off on this tangent.
Okay, we're not. But
just a quick tangent. Andrew Garfield's the best person ever.
Andrew Garfield is the one of the most underrated actors in Hollywood.
I don't know.
He's fantastic.
And if you guys like The Black Phone and you're looking for a miniseries, I actually think that show.
Under
the Banner of Heaven, that miniseries with Andrew Garfield has similar like tension building to The Black Phone. So if you're interested in like, oh, I want to see like a tense thriller, you actually would really like that.
There's just nothing supernatural.
There's nothing supernatural about it.
It's actually very religious.
It is, which I, you know, same thing with like, I love movies and shows that like aren't afraid to tackle taboo subjects. And when they're done right, you know, and they're not like, oh, listen to this, you big, like, you know what I mean? Like the type of things that you hear in like, I don't know, a lot of the Marvel shows nowadays and just like kind of like over your head messaging with certain things. I feel like a show like Under the Banner of Heaven shows the negatives of like what, you know, men can do in a given enough power and given enough room to like get away with murder, essentially. It's a very interesting story.
Like if you want to watch like good Andrew Garfield stuff, just you need to watch the first of the Red Riding trilogy, 1974, The Year of Our Lord. Wonderful. And that was like early stuff from him. He was like a kid still. Not, I mean like a young man.
Yeah.
You know, but
back to The Black Phone. We loved it. I can't wait to see it again. I actually kind of want to go see it again. Maybe bring like the girls and my husband.
Yeah.
Cause I feel like they'll appreciate it. Cause who hasn't been bullied?
Bring the wife, the significant other.
Yeah. It's a great movie. And I genuinely, it seems like one of those horror movies that I'm going to be able to watch over and over I'm, again. I'm
just excited for like Scott Derrickson just leaving Marvel and doing like horror.
Going back to his horror roots. Yeah.
Because I just hate like Marvel, Disney, these Hollywood multiverse universe, MCU, DC.
That's why he's giving me shit about the multiverse.
It's just they're all blah.
Very boring.
They're so boring.
And they're not willing to stray from the formula, because straying from the formula too much. Meanwhile, you have someone like James Gunn who's now done multiple superhero movies and books.
James Gunn is the only I'm only looking forward to of all the Marvel stuff, I'm only really looking forward to Guardians 3. That is it.
Yeah. Not Love Thor.
Love and Thunder.
Love Thor.
Thor, Thunder. Thunder Love.
Thunder Love and Thor. I don't care.
Thunder Love.
Oh, yo.
I think I want to know you.
We've done this before.
I mean, we could go off a little bit on since we're
already on a tangent.
It's not a total tangent, but mostly. I'm really not. I mean, I know we've probably said this before, but the cinematic universe, that's the word I was looking before. Cinematic universe of something. Scott Derrickson, no Black Phone cinematic universe. Unless it makes a shitload of money, I guess. And then do whatever you want.
I wouldn't trust Scott Derrickson and see Robert Cargill with doing
a cinematic universe,
not a cinematic universe. If they want to like pick up other Joe Hill stories,
you wouldn't trust them?
No, I would.
I was like, what the fuck's wrong with you?
I would definitely trust them to do that other one I was telling you about, the Happy Face Murders.
Yeah.
Let me find the fucking actual thing. Go ahead.
You find while I rant. I'm just so sick.
We're gonna be here for a while.
No, I'm just so sick of freaking these cinematic universe creps. You know, like I'm just done with it. I can't deal with it. They're so boring. They're so formulaic. And it's just blah. And watching Doctor Strange, after I really enjoyed the first Doctor Strange, even though when you go back to it, it's all kind of the same. But at least it had nice visuals and it's different. This had nice visuals, but what was with that shitty third CGI eye? See what I did there?
Yeah.
It was just crap. I just didn't care for it.
I think realistically, they should have just picked other stuff to do once the... It ended for me with Endgame, and I still didn't love Endgame.
No, I hated Endgame. I hate's a strong word. I was just really disappointed with it.
Yeah, but especially after Endgame, Infinity War. How are you not?
Infinity War was like the pinnacle of the cinematic universe, and then Endgame was like the thank God it's over. And believe it or not, like watching No Way Home, like now I've seen it 3 times, and I'm like, okay, it was. You know what the best thing about No Way Home was? Andrew Garfield. But I liked No Way Home, and believe it or not, the ending with Peter going into basically, in a way, almost like a new universe with the regular costume, hand sewed, you know, like he's poor. He's...
By the way, I've been calling it the Happy Face Murders.
What is it called?
It's called Best New Horror.
Wow, you're way off.
But the story that I mentioned in Best New Horror is like the Happy Face Murders or something like that. Very good. That's why it's... Oh, no, it's called Button Boy.
Oh, my God. You're like, what the fuck's wrong with you? Oh, the horror is having like, oh, moment.
I know. But I would absolutely...
You're a tutu-head.
I know. I would very much love if Scott Derrickson and C. Robert Cargill did Best New Horror as a movie.
I would just... I'm more like, just do... Good horror. I don't need all the Joe Hill stuff adapted.
I specifically just wanted that story adapted because I feel like it almost speaks to horror lovers in general. And the ending has a very, like, I don't know, I felt very attached to it. Shush. I felt very attached to it being a horror lover. And I feel like if you ever get around to reading it, you would feel the same way. And I think that's something that they would be really good at, especially given the visuals in the story itself. That's all I'm saying.
So have you watched any horrors recently besides...
just this. We do this every time.
I've seen a couple of horror movies lately.
What have you seen?
I saw the terrible movie Curtains.
Oh, God. Why are we talking about this? I saw it too. Why are you bringing it up?
Because it was horrible. Are we going to do a show on that one? Well, we noticed something about it. I think we could do a...
Do you want to just talk about it here?
No.
Then we have to wait. And we have to wait because our 40th episode...
Yes.
Just so you guys know, we're going to be reviewing The Thing finally.
Yeah, but we can't wait like a whole lot. Oh, no, we could just... Well, we're going to review The Thing for our 40th.
For our 40th episode. Yes.
And then we're going to go see it in the theaters because it's coming back to
theaters.
In theaters.
Yeah. So. It's... This summer is the 40th anniversary of... of its release.
Last week,
right.
June 25th,
I think. Yeah. But we're going to see it for your birthday weekend.
Yes, we're seeing my birthday weekend.
Prior to your birthday
weekend. And then the week after my birthday is They Live. We're going to see in theaters.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty excited. I don't know if you guys know this. Like, you can see John Carpenter's They Live and The Thing out in theaters this summer.
Try to find it. One's 35th year anniversary, and one's 40th.
Yeah, crazy, right? I also saw another really good horror movie, slow burn horror. It's called Seder. Have you heard of it?
No.
Yeah. Very, like, 7 years in the making. Very, like, folklore horror. I'm not going to say elevated horror because I hate that word.
Not everything needs to be elevated horror.
No, because elevated horror is just trying to say that other horror is shit, you know? And then like,
yeah,
elevated.
I kind of hate that term now.
Yeah. I hated it since like Scream started using it. Well, maybe even a little bit before that, actually. And then I think maybe Scream was just making fun of it, obviously.
Probably.
Yeah. So, all righty. I think we're done.
Yeah.
But go see The Black Phone.
Please go. Give these fucking movies that are like new and interesting a follow.
First of all, if you listen to this without watching it, like shame on you. But thank you for watching and listening to this.
Either way.
Yeah. But go watch The fucking Black Phone and do it this weekend so it makes money and horror gets supported and in the theaters because it's cheap to make and it's better than anything else out there.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's one of the last formats that is willing to take risks, which I appreciate.
Yeah. Like everything else for the most part is just dull and like, you know, like cinematic universe shit. So, yeah. And we're fucking sick of it. Aren't you sick of it? I'm sick of it.
We're sick of it.
Yeah. We're sick of it.
And with that, we're so happy that you joined us as always.
Bye.